Okay, welcome everyone to another episode of the Big Questions with Big John. Obviously, I'm Big John of the two of us on your screen right now. Make no mistake about who's Big and John in that situation. All right, let me take a quick second here to introduce my guest. My guest is a senior editor at Reason Magazine, where she covers criminal justice, free speech, feminism, and, of course, libertarian issues. She's known for her in-depth reporting on sex work decriminalization, surveillance, and media bias, and she has been a leading voice in challenging moral panics and government overreach. She's the co-founder of the libertarian feminist group Feminists for Liberty, where she brings a nuanced perspective to discussions on personal freedom and individual rights. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Daily Beast, among several other places of note. Everyone, please welcome Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Elizabeth, how are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, my pleasure. And we were talking just briefly before the cameras turned on. And yeah, folks, I've been following Elizabeth on Twitter since back when I was still in sports journalism, when I had nothing to do with libertarian work or anything like that. Always a good follow. And I certainly suggest that everyone find Elizabeth on X now and follow her as well.
Or Blue Sky.
I got to get used to saying that. I don't know if I'm ready to commit to that leap yet, Elizabeth, but or Blue Sky as well. Thank you. Okay, so just let's start at the beginning. Where were you born? How were you raised? What was the environment you were raised in?
I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where I am right now. I moved away for college, and then I was in D.C. and New York for like 15 years between the two. But in 2020, my husband and I moved back here for what we were like, just for like a few months because our offices are closed. And here we are like 5 years later. So now I'm calling Cincinnati home again after many years as an East Coast resident.
Yeah, and being a New Yorker myself, I have to admit, I've never seen the fascination personally of people who want to leave New York. I'm a born and bred New Yorker through thick and thin. I was born in the Bronx.
Okay.
So I was raised really in the 70s in some of the worst nightmarish scenarios, you know, the Fort Apache section. And then for a relief, I went to school in Washington Heights. So two of the worst neighborhoods for people outside of New York in some of the roughest times, pre-Giuliani, yeah. Pre-cleanup and everything. But I noticed you have a very Chappelle-like arc, right? You came to New York, then you went back to Ohio. You know, I think that's his path as well.
So. Yeah. He lives not far from here, from Cincinnati.
Oh, cool. So just give me a little insight into that. What was it like? I always am fascinated with how people, their environment, and what may have led them to embrace, say, libertarianism or individual liberty. So growing up in the Midwest, what was your sense of the environment you were raised in? Was it conservative in your estimation, liberal? How do you feel, even aside from politics?
Yeah, I mean, pretty conservative. Like, I went to Catholic school for most of my life. I grew up in Cincinnati in general is very Catholic. I grew up in a very Catholic, suburb of Cincinnati called Reading. My whole family is, relatively politically conservative, I think, and just sort of, culturally conservative,
right.
But also I feel like Midwest people are less likely to really talk about, or at least in Ohio, or less likely to really sort of be very in your face about it.
Right.
And my parents, while definitely not liberal, I think they both have a very strong libertarian streak. Like, I would find out as an adult that actually my dad had voted for a lot of libertarian candidates. My mom, I don't think she even knew what the word libertarian meant, but like they both had a very libertarian streak. So I think that was sort of instilled in me from a very young age without them ever calling it libertarianism or me sort of recognizing that.
Right. The libertarianism comes out upon reflection, right? Like,
yeah.
So some of the things. Yeah, I found that too. Like, I always knew my father, for example, was a registered Democrat growing up. But it was weird because he never voted for a Democrat. So when I asked him, I said, why are you a registered Democrat? He would tell me these stories. And he goes, well, first of all, he goes, when I came to this country as an immigrant, Harry Truman was president. So I felt I owed it to the Democrats since they were in power when I came here in 1948. But I think by 1949, he was like, I'm not a Democrat. But he never bothered switching his political affiliation, which was always weird to me. Like, he was a big Goldwater guy.
Yeah.
And a big Nixon guy. So So it's funny that upon reflection, you would say, oh, no, what you were really interested in was libertarianism.
Yeah. I mean, and my parents, they're like the quintessential Ohio swing voters, too. Like, they have voted for, you know, Republicans, libertarians, Democrats for president. So it's, you know, it's interesting. But also, I think also Catholicism, I mean, it's weird because I don't really, I say I'm culturally Catholic now. You know, spiritually, I think I'm an atheist. But I do feel like Catholicism had a big impact, too, just because, you know, there's a lot of stuff about, at least in the way my mom, you know, interpreted it and passed it on to us, about like, not judging people and not, you know, not knowing where everyone's coming from, so not sort of making snap judgments about their motives or what they need. And I think that actually kind of has sort of was ingrained in me in a way that comes out in my libertarian leanings, too.
That's interesting, because I've always said my mom... she was born and raised, for the most part, in Greece. And then when she came here, like, I would describe her as just being a humanist. Like, she couldn't tell you who's president, like, what their politics are. She just goes by, are people suffering? Are people hurting? Yeah. How can we alleviate suffering? Which at times is not libertarian at all, right? Because her knee-jerk reaction is, if the government has money, they should give it to someone if it'll alleviate suffering. But I know that her position is also like, well, cut them off if it's making them lazy, or cut them off if they're not self-sufficient, or if it's preventing someone from being self-sufficient. And at first blush, you'd be like, wait, those are incompatible, or inconsistent, I should say. But then when you realize she's viewing it just like a mom's position, which is, I just want what's best for these people. Everybody, you know, she could find the worst serial killer and she'll say, like, oh, I wonder how his poor mother's feeling right around now. You know, it's like,
yeah.
So it sounds like maybe your mom was in that same category, right? It sounds like maybe she had a humanist streak to her that kind of passed itself down to you.
Yeah, a very pragmatic politics almost is what you kind of I think of as my mom, and what it sounds like you're describing. You know, not based on any sort of particular allegiance or anything, but just like, oh, well, this makes sense. We're going to help people. Oh, but this also makes sense. We're not going to, you know, do things that enable dependency, or you know, we're not going to get all up in everybody's business about things. You know. So.
Yeah, and actually I do find that that's also very, you know, people attribute this to New Englanders. Obviously, the good fences make for good neighbors. But I've also found in my travels that that happens to be a Midwestern trait, too, as well, right? Like keeping to yourself, not sticking your beak in other people's business. Do you think that's, say, different from a New Yorker, where if you live in Manhattan or the Bronx or Queens or something, one of the boroughs, you always know what your neighbor's up to. And I think that part of that, is, aside from any political leanings, is shaped just by proximity, right? Like, there's always someone seemingly on top of you. Whereas if you go to the Midwest or anywhere, actually, where there's space between people, do you feel that's an environment that fosters, like, a libertarian outlook?
I mean, maybe. I think there's probably something to that. I definitely didn't grow up in, I mean, you know, I grew up in a pretty densely populated suburb and right outside of Cincinnati, which is, you know, in itself a decent sized city. So I don't think that there is much of that sort of thing. I do think there is this sort of like space driven private libertarianism. But I mean, like, I grew up around a bunch of like Catholic church lady gossips, too, who were all up in everybody's business. So. Don't get me wrong about that.
Now, listen, in those circles, too, you tend to get good recipes for good eats, you know, like when they're all in the same area. Like, but I hear what you're saying. I was looking through your educational background, and it's kind of interesting, right? Because I see initially you got a degree in theater from Ohio University, then a certificate in nutrition from Cornell. I don't know what level that is, but obviously interested in nutrition. And then your master's was in strategic communication. So that sounds to me like that, not that it's a weird journey, because I can see a
it's
string.
A weird journey.
I could see like a string of association, right? Where, you know, like I think of it like, for example, I'm a biologist by training. Then I got a degree in computer science. Then I became an analyst. Then I became a podcaster. Then I became a show host. Then I became a sports journalist. And people say, wow, that's weird. You're all over the map, right? But I tell people, I said, if you look closely in all those endeavors, there's always a love of numbers, like whether it's in the sciences or reporting on something or whatever. What's the string that took you from art to, I should say, theater to nutrition to communications?
So I actually, I did journalism in high school. I was kind of torn between journalism major and theater major, but I did a double major for like a minute, and I found the journalism classes very boring, and theater classes were much more fun. So that's why I went with that. I wasn't an acting major. I was a playwriting major. So definitely, it was within the realm of writing. And so when I got out, though, I mean, obviously you can't make a living as a playwright like maybe two people in the world do. I was like, I don't want to – I was not into the idea of being like, you know, working like some sort of retail or restaurant job or whatever while I like, you know, plugged away my plays at night. I was just like, I want to write for a living. So I ended up getting a job at a local – I lived in Columbus, Ohio. I got a job at a business and legal newspaper there. And so that was my first journalism job. And it was really great, though, because I just had to, like, read all these court cases and learn how to read court cases. I had to interview every judge in the county as part of my, like, year that I worked there. Wow. So I, you know, talked to a bunch of appellate judges, and I learned a ton about the legal system, which would, you know, that's a big focus of mine today. But it wasn't like I had any particular, like, I didn't set out trying to do that. So it was interesting. But then I went to an Institute for Humane Studies summer seminar in DC for like recent college graduates. And that's where I learned that libertarianism was a thing and that was what I was. Like, that was the missing piece. Up till then, I was just kind of like, well, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I don't know. I'm a misfit. And then I was like, oh, this is what I am, or a classical liberal maybe. So I also got to go. I got a Reason magazine subscription through them. I got to tour the Cato Institute, and I learned about think tanks and that those were a thing that existed, which I also hadn't, you know, known. And I thought, you know, journalism's okay, but like, I don't, you know, it was not working at a newspaper in Ohio did not pay well at all. And I was like, maybe I could get a job doing like communications for a think tank or for a nonprofit advocacy group or something like that. So I decided I was going to go to school and get my graduate degree since my undergrad was in theater, and I thought that would be a hard switch to make. So I went to American University, and sorry, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit here, but.
No, it's okay. Please.
I went to American University. I got a graduate degree in strategic communication, and with the intent of going into PR after that. And then I was like, as I'm doing the program, I was like, nope, I don't actually want to do this. I just want to go back into journalism. So that's what I did. I worked for the professor that I like assisted was a baby boomer scholar. So that somehow landed me a job at the AARP, which I ended up working at for 5 years, in my 20s working, writing about retirement. yeah.
At least you probably got your IRAs and your 401k set up, right?
Yes. And I know about how to, you know. I don't know. So I did write a little bit about health and things like that there, though. And so I started doing some health journalism. I always wanted to, you know, write about politics, and I did a little bit freelance for various smaller publications. Right. But, there was never a job at Reason that fit. That was my dream publication even then, but, you know, it didn't open up. So I wound up getting a job for a women's health blog and writing a lot about fitness and nutrition. And that's really where my like, interest in nutrition started, and so I wanted to like learn more about that. So I did this online certificate program through Cornell. I mean, it was not a big thing at all, but it was, you know, I had to take a couple classes online, and it was really interesting. It gave me some good like basics of understanding nutrition knowledge. And since then, I mean, I read about nutrition stuff all the time. Still, I read a lot of books about and papers, and I'm still a big nutrition nerd. But I worked for a few years doing health journalism, and this kind of coincided with when I was in New York for a while. And then in 2014, I saw a job open up at Reason for a staff editor, and I applied, and that's how I ended up at Reason. The thing just to, you know, to, there is not really a thread tying all of it together, I guess, except for sort of, you know, being interested in words maybe, but that doesn't really talk about the nutrition. But I always wanted to write about nutrition, not necessarily, right, you know, practice it. I feel like a lot of health journalism is really bad, and I wanted to sort of be able to explain, you know, nutrition concepts better to the public. So the thing at Reason is just that, you know, I do find that all of these weird things that I did have actually come in really handy. Like, you know, working for a legal newspaper in the beginning has just, you know, now I do a lot of stuff about, you know, I mean, everything I do is usually informed by court records, and I sort of am a legal reporter for Reason in a roundabout way. I do sometimes write about health and nutrition stuff for them. Not as much these days, but I did for a while. And so I have found that, like, a lot of the different threads of my career over the years did come in handy in informing, like, the work I do now.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And I think to your point, like, when you talk there, yeah, the obvious thread is you just love to write. You love to inform. You love to, you know, get to the bottom of something. So yeah. I think that's the thread, whether it's nutrition or, you know, the art thing, you have to sort of shoehorn a little bit, I think. But if you, once you clarify that you were more of a writer than an actor or a performer, then that makes sense as well. So yeah, no, that's super interesting. Thank you for that. You mentioned Reason. Now I've always viewed Reason as a very good source for, especially if you're trying to introduce someone to libertarianism, I've always found Reason to be a really great, source for things like that. I remember when my niece was 12, I gifted her a subscription to Reason, you know, so because I wanted to start her early on libertarianism, you know. But however, lately, you do see a lot of backlash against Reason from some of the more, I don't know what word to use. I'll use their word, even though I don't agree with it, right libertarians. Talk to me about that a little bit. Like, having been there for a while now, I'm sure you've experienced the pendulum swing both ways, right? Where Reason was considered like, hey, this might be the height of libertarian journalism, to these guys are globalists, they're leftists, they're shills for mainstream media, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about that and your perspective on how that sort of is happening.
I mean, I think we get both accusations. It's pretty funny, you know. You'll have in the same week, the same day, you'll have people accusing, you know, you or Reason of being just like actually just right wing or actually just left wing. We constantly get, oh, Reason is too friendly to the left, Reason is too friendly to the right. And, you know, I think part of it is just a lot of people that consider themselves libertarian lean one way or the other more. I'd say more lean to the right than not, but there are, you know, a significant portion of libertarians that lean more to the left. And everybody sort of wants us to be on a particular team, even if, you know, like, they know we're libertarian, but they want us to be libertarian in favor of Republicans or libertarian in favor of Democrats.
Right.
And, I mean, Reason just really isn't. It really is willing to hold everybody accountable and to criticize everybody's actions. And on the occasional, you know, small instances where good is done by either party to give due, right, you know, credit where due. And obviously, like, individual writers might lean more one way or the other, but I think, you know, as an institution, like, it really is not, you know, more right or more left. And so that bugs people because people want us to be more right or more left. And also, I think people want us to be more stridently libertarian, even though, like, you won't find positions that are not libertarian in Reason, you know,
right.
You won't. But sometimes they're not the most, you know, we're not making the most extreme libertarian case, or we're coming to the same conclusion as you might on like the most extremist libertarian grounds, but we're giving reasons for it that are like a little bit more, you know, more normie, you might say. And I think people get mad about that, but that's also kind of a misun, you know, some people want us to be the organ of like the libertarian movement or the organ of like libertarian party and sort of just be appealing to libertarians and being like the most libertarian like we can be.
Right.
When I think Reason's project, it definitely is now. And I think, you know, always has been, as far as I know, has been outreach to general audiences, right? Like, we don't want to just be preaching to people who already believe the things we want to believe. We want to be sort of a, you know, reaching out to people who maybe don't know what libertarian is or don't consider themselves libertarian, but are like, hey, like, wow, I agree with them about this criminal justice issue, or I agree with them about this free speech issue, or whatever. And then therefore start to think like, well, you know, maybe I'll look into libertarian ideas, or at least, you know, maybe I'll form a coalition with them on this issue or something like that.
Right,
so
right.
I think that is people want us to be more just for libertarians, and that's not really what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and like I said, I always found it to be like, if someone says to me, like, real quick, like, is there a newspaper or a magazine or something or a blog that I could follow about that'll give me a good insight into what libertarianism is, like, especially for younger kids, like college age kids, I always point them to reason, you know, and then they could form their own sharpness of which way they want to lean. But I have found it, and just for transparency, like I've never considered myself a political animal. I've just tipped my toes in that water for the last 4 or 5 years. Prior to that, I was just, you know, I always say I'm not a Ron Paul guy. I'm a Milton Friedman guy. That was my draw into politics in 1979, I think it is, when I saw him on Donahue explain why, you know, Ralph Nader was wrong, you know, or something like that. So my entry was not this fire and brimstone thing. It was very professorial, right? Like if you obviously Milton Friedman would just sit there and answer questions, right? And he didn't care who was yelling at him. So to me, that represented a certain type of approach that I loved, right? And then when you look into the positions, you learn more. To the extent that, and reason is sort of the focus of this, but to the extent that you have the constant libertarian infighting, the constant, you know, you put three libertarians in a room, you get three different definitions of libertarianism type of thing, do you think that's inherent specifically to libertarianism, or is it just that there's more vocal people in a much smaller group, which libertarians are, especially compared to conservatives and liberals, that it just seems to it seems to bubble to the surface more evidently?
Yeah, I think it's inherent in any sort of political movement. You know, I think we see it. I think, you know, I mean, there's huge disagreements on the left. There's huge disagreements within small segments of the left. Same on the right. I just think that, you know, they have more of apparatuses like meant to show message discipline at like some levels, you know? So yeah, so casual observers, at least I think, don't, you know, necessarily see all this infighting that goes on behind the scenes. And also, you know, a lot of times nobody sees it unless you're part of that movement. So, you know, being sort of part of the libertarian circles, I think we see it, we're exposed to all of it. It feels like, gosh, like we don't, you know, we're particularly bad at this, but I think that's just because that's the circle we know. Because I find that like whatever sort of circles I get involved in, it's similar. I mean, like, it's amazing the infighting that goes on within the sex worker rights like community, because like that's a pretty small community. You think like, okay, everybody's got sort of the same goals, like this should be, and there's like huge amounts of infighting about like the best tactics and who should be the, you know, the most visible, and just all of this stuff. So I think, yeah, I think it's fairly common.
Yeah. And it, so on sort of a related topic as we transition to other things I want to talk about, but earlier you quickly mentioned like, I guess I'm a classical liberal, I think is how you quickly described yourself, or at least when you were younger. Do you feel we do a disservice to libertarianism if we fall into the right-left paradigm when describing ourselves? You know, it's funny, you know, you talk to certain people, and I had the chance to talk to Walter Block, and he kind of gave me, he says, no, this is how you should describe us, four categories: anarchists, minarchists, constitutionalists, classical liberals. And he kind of like, and I said, you know, that's a pretty good classification to me because it doesn't incorporate the right or the left paradigm into it. Do you agree with that, or do you believe in facilitating sort of like throwing out libertarianism and putting it in terms that most, especially uninitiated people, would understand being right or left?
No, because I don't think we fall on the right left spectrum anywhere comfortably, and you know, like the right left spectrum doesn't fall anywhere like categorizable these days. You know, it's such a weird topsy turvy political time that it's hard to even say what is right or left. Like, I mean, in the American context, right, you can say like what Republicans are for at this moment and what Democrats are for, but it doesn't necessarily fit in with traditional notions of right or left. It doesn't necessarily fit in with European notions of right or left. So yeah, I think it's best to describe ourselves outside of it. I still, you know, I still call myself a libertarian. I also will call myself, like, within libertarianism, yeah, I feel fall more in the classical liberal category. And I try to, yeah, I mean, I think it's funny whenever anybody calls me on the right or left, because it's just neither of those work. And I'll also get a lot of times, like, especially Kat Murdy and I, who run Feminists for Liberty together, you know, we'll get that we're left libertarians, because people think that that means, like, we are, like, you know, sort of have, like, align more with the left on social issues. But, like, that's not what left libertarianism historically means. Like, left libertarianism is more of a willingness to sort of not believe in property rights in some contexts and things like that. And we're like, no, like, I mean, we are fully libertarian. There is no, like, left libertarianism about it. Like, everything we're saying is just a libertarian position. Just because we're personally more sort of socially liberal doesn't mean that, like, our libertarianism is. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does, and I'm glad you kind of mentioned it, because that was going to be one of the topics I kind of transitioned into, so I'm glad you kind of gave me the segue for it. I actually had Kat on, it's maybe 2 years ago, and I'm disappointed in myself for not keeping up with her a little bit more. But talk to me a little bit about the Feminists for Liberty, because what I would like, if I'm being totally cynical, I would say, hey, what part of the feminist supplements what's missing in libertarianism, and vice versa, perhaps? Like, so to me, as a libertarian, I'm like, yeah, of course, women, in the traditional sense that feminism has been used, I would be like, yeah, sure, libertarianism, de facto, part of libertarianism. So tell me about feminists, Feminists for Liberty, is that it?
Yeah,
Feminists for Liberty. What is their sort of viewpoint that makes it sort of the need? Why does it need to exist if we have libertarianism, I guess, is the general question.
Yeah, I mean, definitely libertarianism at its core, I think, and is a feminist philosophy, right? Like, I mean, it believes in, you know, equality under the law, regardless of your sex, regardless of your gender.
Right.
But historically, libertarianism has a lot of times neglected women's issues. I mean, it's not like if asked, a lot of libertarians would say, like, no, I'm not for these sorts of things. But, like, there's been a sort of void of talking specifically about some things, like issues that are more salient to women, maybe, or more, you know, applicable to women's lives. I think there's just sometimes been, because the movement was more male or for whatever reason, like, a lot of those issues have been overlooked. So, like, one thing we want to do is just, like, be libertarians who are talking about women's issues. And then the other thing is that, like, within the feminist movement, I mean, there also has always been different feminisms, different
right.
wings of the feminist movement. There was always a sort of classical liberal feminist movement, and then there was always a more, you know, socialist feminist movement, a more progressive feminist movement. I think people think that it's always been, some people have been, you know, mistaken idea that it's always been sort of one movement over time, but there's always been, and there's this great book by Joan Kennedy Taylor, who founded the Association of Libertarian Feminists and worked with Cato and all sorts of stuff in the 70s and 80s and 90s. But she wrote a book called Reclaiming the Mainstream, and it's all about how, like, over time, there's always been this push and pull between feminists who were more fighting for, you know, women's rights as a project of individual rights, as a project of equality before the law, and then the feminists that were fighting for, like, special protections for women and, you know, sort of more big government interventions to help women and things like that. Definitely in, like, this, you know, day and age, in the past decade or more, like, that wing of feminism is, you know, the most prominent. I think so much so that people think, like, that's what feminism is. It's advocating for special rights for women. It's advocating for more government programs for women. But, you know, that's not how we view feminism. That's not how it's always been viewed. So that's sort of the other thing that we want to do is just, like, interject ourselves into feminist discussions, but with libertarian solutions. Because, you know, so often you have people being like, oh, well, I want to help women achieve this, or I want to help parents, you know, I want to help mothers achieve this. So automatically it's like, okay, what government program can we have? And you don't have anybody stepping back and saying, like, well, whoa, 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 like, what if we didn't do it through the government? Or, like, whoa, 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 what if right. this thing that you say is going to protect women is going to actually backfire in this way? And we don't have anybody pointing that out a lot of the time. So that was the other sort of thing we wanted to do. So it's not like we're saying that libertarianism isn't feminist on its own, but just that, like, it's sort of more of a framing thing. Like, look, here's the issues we want to talk about, and here's kind of who we want to talk about them with.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with you fully. And of course, what's more individual than saying, like, hey, here's my situation and how I think my situation can be resolved in a libertarian context, right? That's what's yeah. more individualist than that, right? So I hear what you're saying, and I agree with it, and I think it's great. That you and Kat have co-founded, right?
Yeah.
The group. So I think that's great. Okay. Moving on. The other thing that a lot of people may know you for, rather, is your reporting on sex work, sex trafficking, contraception, reproductive rights, human sexuality. I don't know if that's a general enough header for you or not. So let me just ask you a couple of questions about that. One of the things that you're known for is that you kind of challenge the notion of the official levels of sex trafficking. You also go to a great length to distinguish sex trafficking from sex work and why one, the former is something we're not interested in as libertarians, and the latter should be something that should be protected as being an individual's choice. Can you talk to me a little bit about those things, starting with, say, the definition, your distinctions between sex trafficking, sex work, and then we could talk about the official numbers around trafficking.
Yeah, so, you know, sex work is sort of an umbrella term that can include all sorts of, professions that involve commercial exchange and sexuality, from, you know, strip clubs are, you know, being a stripper is a form of sex work, period, and porn is a form of sex work, being a, a phone sex operator, I don't know if those still exist, but, you know, was a form of sex work, dominatrix is a form of sex work. The big one that gets talked about in the most sort of battlefield way is prostitution, which is obviously a form of sex work. So this, people refer to that as full service sex work. Basically, you know, sex work implies an element of agency. So it is consenting, people who are consenting to be involved in this sort of activity, consenting adults. Sex trafficking, implies that agency is not present, either because someone is a minor and, legally unable to consent, or because there is force or fraud or coercion being employed to sort of render them not able to be doing this of their own free will. So, sex trafficking is against the law, obviously, against federal law, against all state laws. A lot of sex work is not against the law, but prostitution is against the law almost everywhere in the United States, outside of, a few counties in Nevada. So libertarians have always, have historically, not always, but libertarians have for a long time been, into the idea that, like, prostitution should not be illegal. It's between what two consenting adults want to do with their bodies and with their money is, their business. If they want to do that in private, it should be allowed. When I started, so that was when I started Reason, one of the things I wanted to write about, because that's just an issue that's always interested me. And, I quickly realized that, like, the idea of sex work and the idea of different kinds of sex work, like prostitution, had gotten really wrapped up in the idea of sex trafficking, because there has been this campaign since sort of the 90s involving some people on the Christian right and some people on the radical feminist left trying to make it so that all sex work is viewed as sex trafficking. And so there's been, like, a whole lot of deliberate muddying of the waters, so much so that by this point, it's a mess. You have police departments and prosecutors and politicians routinely referring to just sort of old-fashioned vice things, where they're busting people for prostitution, as sex trafficking things, sex trafficking operations. You have people refer to all sex workers as victims. You have people refer to anybody who pays a sex worker, all prostitution clients, as sex traffickers. Under some laws, they legally are. So, a big thing that I've done at Reason is try and sort of bring some clarity to this mess.
Yeah, and one of the cases that you got some notoriety for by covering it, but just in general, is the Backpage.com situation.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough, I had Stephen Lemons on the show to talk about it, and he mentioned you, of course. And just, I don't know if people understand just how egregious that was, where the editors of the equivalent of Craigslist, right? And it's interesting because Craigslist capitulated to the government, whereas Backpage did not. They were accused of sex trafficking, among other things, meaning the two editors, owners of Backpage.com. So to your point, and of course, I think that case might have just been settled recently, or most of it. Was it 10 years after the fact, 12 years after the fact? One of the co-founders, I think, committed suicide over this. It's really a tragic story, and it's really a tragic story of government overreach and of these guys tried to comply with the government's request. They tried to cooperate short of saying, we're going to be shutting this down. And yet their compliance was viewed as, it's like, I don't want to turn the show into the Backpage.com, but, to your point, that's what sex trafficking became, because it allowed law enforcement to do a lot of things they couldn't do before, right? And it does infringe on a lot of the things. Now, I don't know. Do you have any comments about Backpage specifically that you want to make?
Sure. Just that you're absolutely correct that it's a huge travesty of justice. Jim Larkin and Michael Lacey were the two co-founders of it. I mean, long-term newspapermen, this is the thing I think people don't realize about them, who, you know, have fought so many, you know, they founded their newspaper in, I think, 1970, the Phoenix New Times. They owned a whole bunch of alt-weekly papers. They fought the government so many times on free speech issues. So it's, you know, I think some people are like, well, why are they, you know, fighting back about this, about sex work ads? Like, they must be some sort of, you know, pervs, or they must be sex traffickers, or whatever. And it's like, no, they are people who really believe, they are journalists who really believe in the First Amendment, and they have been fighting free speech battles of all sorts for decades before Backpage, before this battle even came along. So like you said, Craigslist, you know, they were like, okay, we'll take down our adult services section. Crazy thing is, people still, you know, put sex work ads on Craigslist. It's just slightly more coded, maybe, you know, but people are still putting them in the personal section or whatever. I mean, and now Craigslist has canceled its personal sections too. But when Craigslist canceled its adult section, it did not end adult ads on Craigslist whatsoever. But the government got what it wanted, because it could say Craigslist listened to us and it decided to take sex trafficking seriously and it decided to end its adult ads section, and so we won. And then they went to Backpage to do the same thing so that they could, you know, and then Backpage was like, no, we're not going to, you know, these are not illegal ads. These are ads for, like, plenty of sorts of sex work are illegal. Escorting is legal. Like, it's okay for people to run these ads. And all we're doing is providing a platform for these ads to run. And we're not going to take them down just because you told us to. And I think, I mean, yeah, that was the trouble. They told them no. And they were then determined to make an example of them. And they did. And Michael Lacey, the other co-founder, is now, you know, he was sentenced to 5 years I'm forgetting exactly how much his sentence was, but many, many, many years. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison because he's an old guy. He's now out on he's appealing, and he's now out on in house arrest or on you know, on parole until that, but not parole. Anyways, it's a travesty what happened to them, but, and I think it's so sad. But the other thing to keep in mind too is that, like, this is not just about Backpage. Like, this is a trial balloon for larger things, because all of social media, like all of the platforms that allow user generated content from, you know, X and Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and just, you know, everything, like, sex workers post there. People connect with clients there. Unfortunately, you know, in private messages and things like that, adults sometimes reach out to teenagers there and end up in, you know, sort of relationships with them. Stuff that is both legal sex work is facilitated there, illegal sex work is facilitated there, and sex crimes are facilitated there. Like, nobody can stop that. I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I'm saying, you know, that should be punished when police can't punish it, but you can't stop people from communicating over the internet. So the same, you know, the same logic that's applied to the Backpage case could apply to any other forum for free speech online. And now the government has been trying to do that. I mean, you've seen it since Backpage was shut down. Now they focus on, they'll be like, oh, Twitter or X is really guilty of sex trafficking. Instagram is guilty of sex trafficking. And you're seeing the same sort of playbook apply to them. And I think, you know, the ultimate goal is not, you know, there's no evidence that this is actually helping stop, that this is helping protect children, that this is making it easier. I mean, police and the FBI even put out, or the GAO put out a big report about the FBI saying this has made sex trafficking harder to fight because there's not this online paper trail, blah, blah, blah. There's no evidence of making people safer, but it is, you know, setting this framework for the government to be able to say, like, you know, nice website you've got there, nice internet platform you've got there. We'd hate to have to, you know, put you in jail for 20 years for facilitating sex trafficking. So maybe you should just, like, you know, let us have a backdoor to your encrypted, you know, encrypted private messages. Or maybe you should let us, you know, dictate what you can and can't talk about and not allow any sort of talk about sexuality whatsoever, and so on. Or seeing, you know, so I think it's a slippery slope is the other moral of the Backpage story.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. And I think the people who are pro the government actions, typically it's tied up in the morality around sex work, right? I think that's another big part of it. So that's interesting right there. And, you know, I've also heard the, like, well, if they weren't guilty, why wouldn't they cooperate with the authorities? And the irony is they did in a lot of cases. Like, when I believe Lemons was saying that when presented with evidence like this specific user seems to be a predator who's, you know, they would be like, sure, go ahead. Yeah. Here's the records. Here's everything. Yeah. It's just that we're not giving you this golden key that opens up every encrypted message and all that. So, I think that unfortunately they were treated horribly.
I just double checked. Michael Lacey, the feds wanted to send him away for 20 years. That was what the sentence they asked the judge for. He had 5 years for getting charged for one single count of money laundering.
And it's hilarious, because to your point, money laundering was used as a way of getting them. You know, it's like using tax evasion to get Capone or something like that, right? Okay. Now, just also very briefly, you've challenged the magnitude of sex trafficking, right? Like, there's this number that seems to be quoted. I think it's 300,000, is it? People sex trafficked, the majority of which might be underage, minors. You dispute that, right? Like, do you agree with that sort of official government? Right?
I mean, there's so many bad statistics out there. And when you poke just about any of them, you will find that they're just based on literally absolutely nothing sometimes, or at most they're based on just like massive misreading of studies. This is one of the latter. It's people will say now, like, oh, 300,000 kids are sex trafficked every year in the United States. What it comes from is a study that said 100,000, so I don't know how it got multiplied by 3 somehow, but 100,000 kids a year are at risk of being sex trafficked. Not that they were being sex trafficked. Also, the study itself, how it determined that kids were at risk, was it like counted if they had these things that it considered risk factors, which included things like living in public housing, having divorced parents, all sorts of things that are like really broad categories. And if a kid had like 2 or 3 or more of these or something, they were like considered at risk of sex trafficking. So it was a very dubious methodology to begin with. I mean, just because, you know, the Richard Estes, the guy who did the study, like now disavows it. He's just like, that was, you should not quote this number whatsoever. But somehow that number became, and people just, because politicians repeated it, all sorts of people repeated it over the years, that it's just become sort of this viral thing that people now turn to this idea that hundreds of thousands of kids are being trafficked every year. And like, there was like nothing to that number. It was just this purely weird speculative number about why, how many people might be at risk based on these sort of made up risk factors. When you actually look at like the numbers of people prosecuted for sex trafficking of a minor in a year, and I know like not all people are, not all cases right. are being caught, but it's in the dozens, or it's rather than the hundreds of thousands. Like, it's just such a huge discrepancy between what we think. Sometimes maybe there's like 100 sex trafficking, convictions in a year or something like that. So even if you say like, okay, well maybe there's, 10 times that or something it's nothing near the thing. And I think the other thing to think about too is just a lot of times when people think like kids being sex trafficked, they think small children, or, they think children. They don't think, 16 and 17 year olds. And they also think of people being, sort of kidnapped or held against their will, or sort of, treated violently and stuff. Well, anytime anyone pays a minor, pays a 17 year old for sex, anytime someone sells sex that's a minor, they're considered a sex trafficking victim. Even if they're, so a 17 year old posts an ad themselves on Craigslist once upon a time, Backpage once upon a time, Snapchat, wherever now, and ends up meeting up with someone and accepting some cash from them for sex, like, they are a sex trafficking victim. So a lot of times when you hear about these numbers, it's, I'm not saying that that's good, right? I'm not saying we should allow that, but I am saying that like, it's very different than this like very heinous scenario you think of. It's very like, almost every case I've ever seen of convictions has been involving, a teenager, and generally an older teenager. And very often it involves them, trafficking themselves, or it involves them believing that someone who is slightly older than them is like their boyfriend and that they love them, and then that person pimping them out, which, again, not good, but like a very different situation than I think people think of when they hear about children being sex trafficked.
Yeah, it is that pop culture thing, right? The movies that are being made, the statements that are being made by politicians. And then once numbers get into the ether out there, it's like almost impossible to roll them back, because if you challenge them, you're part of the, quote, conspiracy to keep it hidden. You're part of, whatever, the Baphomet or whatever. I don't even know what nonsense conspiracies there are in that. But, you just point to them, you could tell. Like the numbers that are quoted around pay inequality, the numbers that are quoted around vaccines and autism. Like, these are things that are verifiably, credible, repeatedly debunked, and yet the numbers out there. Politicians repeat it. Hucksters repeat it. Grifters repeat it. So I think it's important that, you know, you draw that distinction, and pretty happy that you have, you know, like to say, yeah, where there is sex trafficking of the kind that most people associate with that phrase, of course it's horrible. Of course there's crimes being committed, and those people should be held accountable. But like you said, a 17-year-old going out on willingly on a date with a 20-year-old and the dinner being form of something of value does not constitute sex trafficking, but legally it does, right?
Right. I mean, and like these, I think why this is important too is like these things have different solutions, right? If you've got like hundreds of thousands of missing children who are being abducted, and you know, like that's obviously going to require this massive, you know, or if, you know, even if you got hundreds of thousands of adult women who that's happening to, like that requires this massive law enforcement intervention. If the vast majority of sex trafficking victims are like homeless teenagers, trans teenagers who were kicked out of their house,
right,
you know, adult women who are, you know, victims of domestic violence, or, you know, just very poor and don't have anywhere to go and are trading sex for survival, basically for a place to live and for food. Like, that requires that requires more of a social services solution, that requires like shelters, that requires like community resources. Like, that doesn't require mobilizing like SWAT teams, you know? So I think it's important to talk about, you know, the actual reality of it, because otherwise you're not going to be helping anyone. And meanwhile, you're going to be like trampling a lot of civil liberties in order to fight this imaginary problem.
Yeah. And I think especially with the swing or the recent prominence of so-called right libertarians, you always have the morality of it, or their morality of it, tied into it, right? Whereas before, I think most libertarians, for example, could agree that, look, actual sex trafficking, there's no libertarian excuse for that. But sex work is quite different, like you just mentioned, like the strippers, even the prostitutes, the escorts, the massage therapists, in air quotes, that they're providing services, and that it's voluntary, and without this work, they may be out on the street. They may be, you know, and like, if I have these arguments online with someone, inevitably it always comes down to this: oh, I guess you'd be happy if your daughter went into sex work, or you'd be happy if your son took advantage of, you know, girls in that situation. Of course not. But then again, I wouldn't want my daughter to grow up to be a socialist either. Right. And so, I mean, but does that mean I have to keep them under lock and key or criminalize sex work or socialism or whatever, unless they're harming themselves or others? And specifically considering that as libertarians, I think most of us would say that we do believe in an age of consent. So once you get to the point where you can make that decision. So I do think that that distinction is credible, and I do think it's I'm happy that you keep pointing that out so ably, and I think that's good. Okay. One of the other things I want to talk to you about, because I saw some comments about this as I was doing research, declining birth rates. We hear a lot of these pundits, especially I think on what's either the right libertarian, conservative, paleo-conservative, whatever you want to call it. Like, it usually comes from the right, saying like, hey, countries like first world countries, all of them have declining birth rates. This is a bad thing. We need more people on this planet. And, you know, we have to keep up with the rest of the world that's not first world or with the third world countries. We should incentivize people to have more children. And you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. That's nonsense, right? Talk to me a little bit about that and give me a couple of minutes on that.
It's nonsense on so many levels because, I mean, first of all, it's this idea that fertility rates declining is necessarily going to be catastrophic is not necessarily true, right? I mean, like, we had this massive population boom. Like, it's not necessarily a bad thing that you know, fertility rates are starting to fall. Obviously, if they, you know, keep falling, that's, you know, going to be bad. But, like, I think that, you know, people sort of assume that this is necessarily bad, and it's not necessarily bad.
Right.
Second, the idea that pronatalist policies work, and they don't. I mean, this has been proven in so many countries around the world, like basically every country that has tried it, you know, give all sorts of different things, whether that's providing free childcare or giving direct cash payments to parents or, you know, doing tax incentives or just, you know, these all sorts of been tried around the world. And in many of these countries, the birth rate, I mean, in all of these countries, the birth rate has continued to fall. The only exception was France for like a minute, and then its birth rate has now been falling again too and is starting to slide back towards the rest of Europe. So I just think, you know, it's just not, there's no evidence that these policies can move the needle on anything like a significant scale whatsoever. You know, there's some evidence that they might encourage people to have births sooner, so you'll see this tiny little blip of a bump, but not that they do anything long-term for birth rates. You know, and this makes sense because even, you know, even the most generous things, say you're going to give someone $5,000 for every kid that's born, well, like, what is that going to do in the grand scheme of right. raising kids, you
right,
know?
Right.
And also, these are just such personal decisions. It's not any wonder that, like, government policy really can't move the lever here. And then I think, you know, the other thing that's nonsense is this idea that, and you hear this from the right and the left though, like everyone wants to blame their pet thing. So on the right, you'll have like, oh, it's because of feminism or it's because women are like working too much and are, you know, putting off childhood for too long or they don't want men and blah, blah, blah. And then on the left, you'll hear like, oh, it's because we don't have enough free childcare. We don't have like universal paid leave, all this stuff. And again, you can look at these different countries. You can look at the like Nordic social democracies that give people all this stuff. Their birth rates are falling. It hasn't helped. Like you can look at countries like Hungary and other more conservative countries that don't have, you know, that have really tried hard to push this sort of thing. You can look at countries like Italy where and other ones where, you know, the where there's less working women. Their birth rates fell. I mean, actually, some of these ones where less women work out of the home have had the biggest falling birth rates. So it's just it's very clear that neither of the like convenient narratives that the right or the left wants on this is what's happening. And sorry, just can I add one more thing too?
Because I think, sure, absolutely, yeah.
I think that you know another just crazy thing. I was just tweeting about this today. I'm sorry, I still say tweeting.
That's okay.
you know, is that a huge in the United States at least, and to some extent in many of the westernized countries, like. This is a product of falling teenage birth rates. I mean, that's been the biggest driver of it is less
teen pregnancies.
I did see
that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
I did
it's
see
like,
that.
That's, you know, no one's going to say that that's a bad thing or, you know, most people are not going to say that that's a bad thing. This idea that it's being driven by, you know, a whole bunch of rise in childlessness is actually not true. Most people will go on to have some children. People are having smaller families. You know, people wanted to used to have, you know, more people had 4 and 5 kids. Now they're having 1 and 2, but people are still having children and people, and, you know, the drop is mainly concentrated among people that are very young. So I think that there's also some evidence that like this isn't necessarily a bad, you know, there's not bad reasons behind this. It's actually a really good thing that we solved as a society having this massive teen birth rate.
Right. I think sometimes people forget to take the context of things. They look at a specific data point, you know, like I've seen Musk say, we need more. I've seen Jordan Peterson say, you know, these are supposedly people on the right that shouldn't be in your business, really. And then maybe in a lot of other ways, you might agree with them on a lot, but this specifically seems to stick in their craw. And I've said like when, you know, I'm old enough to remember when I was younger, you'd ask like someone like, why do you have 6 kids? And they'd be like, well, we kind of expected half of them to die like sometime between now and by the time they get teenagers. And then we need at least one of them to stick around to take care of us in our old age. Like our pension plan was one of our kids that one of our kids would, you know, now I'm not saying that was prevalent, of course, and that would be everybody's reason for having a lot of kids. But there's a lot of like subtle truth to that you had higher infant mortality rates. Oh, you had more things that could happen to you growing up until you hit your 20s, say, where your kids unfortunately could, you know. So I think people don't take that and they're quick to blame it on whatever, to your point, is antithetical to their political leanings at that moment. So for the right now, it's like, oh, these damn feminists who get a career and, you know, they wait till they're 30 and 35 to have their first kid, you know, and you're like, so what?
Yeah, so I have my kids at 39 and 41. So.
Oh, hey. So, you know, exactly, yeah. you know, and I mean, you take all that into account and then you look at the left and you're like, okay, to your point, which I did not know until I was studying, reading up on your work. It's like, yeah. Teen pregnancies are down. And who wants to see that go up, right? Like, I mean, I think we can all agree that, okay, it's not the end of the world if a teenager gets pregnant, but all other things being equal, you'd rather have them hit 25 where their brain is fully developed, they understand the world around, they understand themselves a little bit better, then they could start thinking about taking on the responsibility of being a parent. So, yeah, that's – I thought it was weird and, again, an interesting topic. Unfortunately, Elizabeth, you are so interesting. I could talk to you for another hour. Unfortunately, we can't. So I want to thank you for our conversation thus far, but I want to end it on what I always call silly questions.
Okay.
These are five things that don't have any right or wrong answers, but it just gives me and the audience a bit of a chance to understand you, Elizabeth, a little bit better. So I'm going to pull out my notes because otherwise, at my age, I will forget these. Okay. On the whole, do you feel that technological advances help or hurt the cause of liberty?
Help.
Can you give me an example? Like AI, do you think feel that's a net positive or a net negative for liberty?
I don't know. I don't yet see it as being either. I guess we'll have to.
It's a blunt instrument right now for you. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that there will be ways it's good for liberty and ways it's bad. Maybe that's how I feel about most technologies, is that like they are sort of tend to be neutral because they introduce new avenues of protecting liberties and also new avenues of invading them. Like the whole, you know, online apparatus of like social media and all that. I mean, it gives itself over to all sorts of government surveillance like never before, but also it's like democratized communication and spread, you know, free speech like never before, and actually helping people, you know, give individuals more liberty too. So I think, yeah, maybe it's a wash is my answer.
Yeah, well, I tend to view it as a tool, right? Like, I think just like we don't blame guns for murder, we shouldn't blame AI for anything positive or negative that comes out of it. Right. It depends on how we use it as a tool. So I agree with you. Okay. If you could ban one word or phrase from the internet forever, what would it be, Miss Free Speech Advocate?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. I don't think I have one. I'm not really, I'm not like as on social media anymore. I used to have like a whole list.
Okay. Like, I'll give you one of mine just to show you the nonsense of this question. It's like, I told my wife when we got married 35 years ago, one of her favorite phrases was six of one, half dozen of the other. Whenever I asked her to make a choice, she would say six of one, half dozen of the other. I told her if I heard it again, I would have to strangle her against my nature because I just hated that phrase, and it's been successfully banned from our household for the last 34 years.
I got one. The fire in a crowded theater.
Ah,
okay. Because people misunderstand like the origins of that so badly, and they also use it to just justify like all sorts of ridiculous things all the time. So, we'll see.
That's a good one. Yeah, because it justifies censorship, really, it, as a cover. Okay, fantastic. Did becoming a parent, as you noted, later in life, did becoming a parent alter your libertarian views in any way?
No, I don't think so. It's more expanded my like categories of interests, you know. I mean, I'm more sort of viscerally interested in issues of, you know, things that like Lenore Skenazy writes about, you know, letting children have freedom, letting parents have freedom. I'm definitely more sort of interested in issues like that, and also just
Lenore Skenazy, is she the advocate of unlearning? Is that
and free range kids?
Free range kids, unlearning. Yeah. That movement. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. Okay, fantastic. What's the weirdest compliment you've ever received about your work? And you could take that as either weird or left-handed compliment, any way you want to interpret that.
I don't know. This is not a very weird one, but I will say I was at giving a talk at a college campus last week, and someone was like, "Oh my God, I'm a big fan. Like, I read one of your articles when I was in seventh grade," and he told me the article, and I was just like, "Oh my God!" Like, it's so like they're so young. They're like that. This, you know, is just it wasn't very long ago that like this article came out. So I was just like, this kid was in seventh grade not very long ago. Oh my gosh! Like, college students are so much younger than me now. So that was like a kind of funny,
I know exactly what you mean. I had that happen to me where. I was in my office as my day job as a consultant, and I call them kids, but it might have been a 20 or 25-year-old, you know. they walked by me and they had a, I was listening to a series of Clash videos on the day. And the guy goes, the Clash, wow, they're cool. I go, oh, yeah. And he says, yeah, I remember my grandparents telling me about them. And I was like, oh, wow, I actually caught them live. So what does that make me? You know, it's like, so that sudden rush to mortality kind of hits you. So I get it. I get it. And the last one, if your journalism career had a theme song, what would it be?
Oh goodness. I don't know. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm like,
that's okay. So let me make it a little bit easier. What genre of music are you into?
You know, lately, like I just, there's like this old jazz station in Cincinnati and I listen to jazz all the time and I listen to classical all the time. This is such a boring answer. I used to listen to like a lot of like new rock and you know, or alternative or whatever you want to call it. But like lately I listen to jazz and classical and then like terrible kids music that my sons who are 3 and 1 years old play for me. Well, they're really into VeggieTales these days. So
VeggieTales. I remember when my son was that age, it was always Blue's Clues, and I still have those songs rattling through my head. But okay. Well, Elizabeth Nolan Brown, senior editor at Reason Magazine, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you coming here on The Big Questions. Please let everyone know, how can they follow your work? Where can they find your socials if you're so inclined? Go ahead, let them know.
Yeah, you can read reason.com. I write a newsletter there that comes out twice a week called Sex and Tech. So if you subscribe to that, you'll have it delivered to your inbox twice a week. You just go to reason.com, I think, /newsletter/sexandtech. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at EN Brown and Blue Sky, which I've been transitioning more to Blue Sky than Twitter lately. So that's why I mention it. LN Brown, Liz Nolan Brown. So that's how you can find me.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And again, join us next episode when we'll have maybe as interesting a guest as Elizabeth Nolan Brown right here on The Big Question with Big John on Grumblings Media. Until then, peace, everyone.